Up next, we have our book reading program, Ohomuni Iyotaka, read by Gail Hubling.
The Long Night is a Crying, a novel by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 22, A Hawk and a Whirlwind. Stands in timber, a young Cheyenne with a pleasant face stood on a rise north of the village and took in sight that made his blood stir. No one knew how many people there were in camp. Only guesses could be made. He estimated there were around 5,000 people, and one of his friends thought there were nearly 9,000 horses. There were so many horses that they had to be broken down into several smaller herds and spread around the encampment to graze. So many that the grass at each new campsite was eaten down to the ground in a matter of 3 or 4 days. Sitting in front of his lodge, he had felt a throbbing, the rhythm of life that begins to rise whenever so many people come together. He had felt it so strongly that he was compelled to climb the low rise, thinking perhaps he could see it or perceive it somehow. He stared at the forest of poles stretching upward like long, thin, intertwined fingers from the tops of hundreds of lodges. An endless forest, it seemed. Below them walked the people of three nations, the Lakota, along with their relatives, the Dakota and Nakota, and the Blue Clouds and Cheyenne. Stans and Timber drew in a deep breath. Somewhere inside of him was a feeling that he would never again see such a sight. People and horses were everywhere. Laughter and conversations floated on the lazy breeze. Full meat racks and empty drag frames stood upright between the lodges. Children moved about in small bunches. Women worked, scraping hides or slicing meat into thin strips to hang on the racks. Babies and cradle boards were numerous, as were dogs, staying as unobtrusively close to the meat racks as they could. Old men sat around in small clusters, watching it all. Walking slowly down the rise and entering the circle of the encampment was like walking into the warm waters of a lake. He could feel a sense of belonging surround him. He followed a line of lodges until he came to the Oglala neighborhood, intending to visit with his friend Crazy Horse. They had not spoken since 2 campsites ago. As always, there was a crowd at his lodge. Stans and Timber took a seat on the ground at the outer edge of the small group. Little Big Man was speaking. Next to him, Gray Bull listened patiently, but from the expression on the older man's face, Stans and Timber knew Gray Bull was not pleased with what he was hearing. From what the agency people hear, Little Big Man was saying, the outpost upriver from Fort Laramie has a large number of long knives. I believe those who attacked Two Moons came from there. It would be wise to consider attacking it. We have at least 700 fighting men here now. Is that not why we are coming together, to do something about the long knives? What better way than to take the fight to them? They would not expect that. I know the agency people hear news about long knives, Gray Bull spoke up, but do we know how many long knives are at that outpost? My guess is that there are 1,000, if not more, and every one of those 1,000 has a rifle and plenty of bullets, and let us not forget their wagon guns. Little Big Man was not dissuaded. Many of us are ready to fight, he countered. Our skills as fighters are better. But does that make their guns less powerful, asked Gray Bull. The younger man's eyes glowed with anger. It can, he retorted, for his quick temper. Almost single-handedly, he had frightened off several white peace talkers only 2 years ago at the Spotted Tail Agency. At the meeting known as the Council to Steal the Black Hills, he rode in and challenged any Lakota who would sign the paper giving away the Black Hills to the whites. It was a brave thing to do, and fortunately, no one had gotten hurt, despite the anger and tension and the long knife's habit of shooting first. But no one signed the paper and the peace talkers left. No one doubts the fighting abilities of our men, Gray Bull replied, or your courage. But it is a good thing to have common sense to go along with courage. We cannot afford to lose a single fighting man. To replace the loss of one experienced fighter is not easy for us. We may have 700 warriors here, but how many of them have the kind of experience you have, nephew? On the other hand, we may kill 1,000 long knives, but 1,000 more will come from their country to the east. I agree with what you say. We must take the fight to them, but we must plan carefully before we do. We have to fight when we know we will win. Stans and Timber noted that everyone nodded, silently agreeing with Grable. Goodweasel, one of the battle-scarred veterans Grable had alluded to, tossed an inscrutable glance at Little Big Man. I, too, agree with what you say, but what Uncle Grable says is also true. Some of our young men have very little experience, and inexperienced men can make mistakes in the heat of battle. I think we should pick the fights we can win. Strike quickly, inflict casualties, and break off. That will give our young men experience as well as confidence. All eyes looked toward Crazy Horse. Our battle leaders have talked about these things, and what my friend says is the method we all agree with. The first thing we need to do is send our scouts in close to the Long Knives outposts and have them use whatever means they can to learn their numbers and the routines they have. Then we can plan how to attack. Warfare against the Long Knives and Whites were the thing most talked about by the men. Most of the younger men assumed that when the war leaders decided there was enough warriors, there would be raids against the Long Knife outposts. They didn't worry about planning the way the older warriors did. Younger men worried about doing well in battle. Many were also thinking about something Crazy Horse had been saying consistently. Fighting the Long Knives and other Whites was not the same as fighting against the Crow or Shoshone. It was not for personal honor. The Lakota and their allies had to fight to kill Long Knives and destroy their will to come after them. Personal honor was no longer as important as survival. The reasons for becoming a warrior, a fighting man, were the same. A warrior's duty was to protect family and home. But now being a warrior was even more important because the Long Knives had turned into the kind of a threat many human beings had not expected. They were like the prairie fire that consumed everything in its path. They didn't understand honor, only destruction and death. Three men sat in the shade of a lodge not far from the group sitting with Crazy Horse. Under the watchful eye of his father, Little Dog was helping Horned Eagle clean a breech-loading rifle. The two young men were 12 when the Battle of the Hundred in the Hand had been fought nearly 10 years ago. Now both were thoroughly trained to be fighting men, but as yet they had not faced Long Knives in a protracted battle. I remember 3 years ago when we went with Crazy Horse and Cloud up to the Elk River, Horned Eagle recalled. The Long Knives numbered 200 or so. Crazy Horse wanted to draw them into an ambush, but they would not chase us. We fired on them, they fired back. Nothing much happened. Remember the bunch we caught napping on a small island in the middle of the river? Little Dog asked. They were surprised to see us. That is exactly what Crazy Horse is talking about, his father said. When I was a young man, war was different. I was with Crazy Horse's friend and teacher when we came across some Shoshone. We fought up close with lances and war clubs. Men were knocked from their horses and rescued by their friends. We fought hard that day. We did not let up and we drove them away. On another day, maybe they would have been stronger, but that is how it goes. Only two of our men were seriously injured. Several of theirs were badly hurt. No one was killed, but when the fight was over, we felt good. We felt strong. Several of us were given eagle feathers later by the old men. At that moment, Cloud and Goings were on the north side of Ash Creek, gazing intently at its waters flowing into the greasy grass. I have not been here in 3 years, Goings commented. He pointed west across the flat plain that stretched to the low hills beyond. But the last time I was, the grass was not this tall or thick. Cloud pointed to the rushing waters of the greasy grass. It is running high, too high to cross. He looked north. We can go north to Dry Creek and get a good look from the slopes of those ridges. There is no need to cross that water. Staying inside the groves of short oak and willow along the banks of the greasy grass, they rode north, choosing the straight course rather than following the meandering river. The ridges on the eastern side of the river rose suddenly, filled with tree-choked gullies that cut down to the water. They proceeded slowly and cautiously, hands on their six-shooters. Staying below the ridge, they climbed to the benches above the river, then across the ridge. Below them was a forest of mostly very old and tall cottonwood trees that could hide anything and anyone. The cottonwood floodplain west of the river was a favorite campsite for many people, especially in the summer or autumn. This year, the grass on the plain was thick and tall, up to a horse's belly, Cloud estimated. Breezes wandered about, whispering softly as they passed through the grasses, making stalks slowly bend and sway. Eagles and hawks soared overhead, and meadowlarks and sparrows flitted among the smaller trees and brush. Cloud spotted a doe and its fawn emerge from the cottonwoods and pause at the west bank of the greasy grass. After a long drink, the doe moved off slowly, a reassuring sign that no one else, two-legged or four, was in the trees. They waited a while longer before they proceeded into the open western slopes of the ridges on the east side of the river. Far to the north, but still south of the Elk River, a young man dressed only in a rabbit-skin breechclout peered at the shadowy overhang of an old watercourse. His hair was loose and short, barely below his ears. His body was covered with cuts, scrapes, and bruises. In his hand was a long pole sharpened on both ends, worked to points by continuous scraping against stone surfaces. It was an effective weapon for defense and more than adequate for spearing fish. On his feet were slats made of pine bark tied with strips of rabbit hide. In a small bag tied around his waist next to the cone-shaped fist trap made of willow stalks were pieces of cooked rabbit. The high bank caught his eye as he was following a creek. Any kind of overhang was shelter, especially one that was out of the wind. This one had large stones scattered across the front, something he knew did not occur naturally. Someone had used this before. Old Coyote moved forward to have a closer look. A step from the stones, he noticed an odd-shaped object behind him. He knew there was nothing or no one inside the overhang. It wasn't deep enough for anything larger than a coyote or a deer. He moved closer until he could poke the object with his spear. It fell away to the inside, and a deep, damp, musty odor wafted outward. He looked around. If nothing else, he had learned that constant alertness was the best defense. He saw nothing, except for hawks and eagles and smaller birds. Turning back, he crawled closer towards the overhang, and the musty, dank odor was more evident. Rising slightly, he saw something he knew was not plant or animal, a swatch of pale blue cloth. He reached in and pushed aside the stones and moved back instinctively from the unexpected sight. Steadying himself, Old Coyote moved forward slowly to take a closer look. Behind the stones were two skeletons. Part of the bank had collapsed on them, probably because of the rain. Tiny bits of flesh and strands of hair still clung to the exposed areas not covered by the faded blue uniforms. With the sharpened staff, he poked at the clothing, then sat back on his haunches for a moment. A thought came, and he pulled more stones aside and dug around the bodies for weapons he knew soldiers always carried. He found nothing. Using the staff, he tried to pry up the closest skeleton, but it was stuck in the earth. Having no choice, he shoved his hands under the coat and pulled up. The skeleton came apart, with the skull rolling down the slight incline. The dank odor was strong. He pried the bones up and out of the dirt, but still found no weapon. The two skeletons were side by side. Old Coyote could only guess that they had taken shelter there. Old Coyote could only guess that they had taken shelter here sometime during the winter and had frozen to death. There were no signs of a fire. However they died, and for whatever reason they were here, he knew they were soldiers. Soldiers without weapons, it seemed. There was probably a story, one that would never be told. Old Coyote touched the uniform coat and pulled at it. It was still intact. It had not rotted from the weather. He sat back to think. He had found clothing. If both uniforms were still intact, he could make use of them. They could be washed in the creek he had been following. The breeze was warm, so they would dry quickly. How he would explain coming home dressed in a soldier's clothing, without weapons and without avenging his sister, he didn't know. But he was alive. That was something. It was the best he could hope for. He had lived on mice and fish and rabbits and spent more days than he cared to remember wandering around naked. From flint, he had fashioned a small finger knife using the point of a deer antler he had found. After four rabbits, he had barely enough height to make a loincloth. But through the cold nights, shivering in a hole or against a bank, he had never felt so alive. Old Coyote glanced at the skeletons. It would be a while before he was in that condition. He thought to bury them in the clearing nearby. Then he realized he had nothing to dig with. Collapsing the overhang over them would be easier. He wouldn't need the shelter now. He had clothes to wear. Goings and Cloud kept a wary eye on the trees across the river as he followed the bank above the east side. From that vantage point, they were at the same level as the tops of the trees across the river. Deer grazed beneath the high canopy of cottonwood branches thick with leaves. Farther to the west, the open prairie was a wavering green floor that stretched to the low hills beyond. How long do you think it will take the horses to graze all that down? Cloud asked, pointing over the trees. More than a few days, Cloud replied, grinning. To their right, the undulating ridges rose sharply above them, their slopes green with grass as well. The bank gradually narrowed and sloped down as the ridge behind ended abruptly with a steep bank, an old slide. Beyond the end of that ridge was a coulee with a narrow water course that reached the river. Water flowed in it during wet springs like now, but for most of the year it was dry. The Lakota called it Dry Creek. To the Crow, it was Medicine Tail Creek. The two riders halted at the end of the bank above the mouth of the creek. A shrill cry of a hunting red-tailed hawk pierced the sky. Cloud glanced up in time to see it set its wings and dive. Look! Cloud caught Going's attention and pointed to the diving hawk. They watched the hawk as it flared out, its tail feathers down in attack position as it struck something hidden in the grass. They saw a puff of fur and a small gray form roll through the grass as the hawk beat its wings to regain its balance, then pounced on the rabbit. The bird sat on its kill for some moments before it began to tear it to its flesh. Both men silently watched the hawk. The red tail had been part of the vision Crazy Horse had had as a boy. Occasionally, Crazy Horse wore an eagle feather in his hair, but more often he wore either a single tail feather from a red tail or a fan of all four tail feathers. The fan pointed down, exactly like the red tail, in attack position. A breeze arose in the trees across the river, shaking the branches of the tall cottonwoods and forming a whirlwind that twisted toward the river. A column of brush and leaves rose and danced inside it. Over the river it sucked up a white mist that dissipated quickly as it hit the eastern bank, crossing in front of the two warriors. With a shrill, the red-tailed hawk launched itself upward, climbed swiftly, rising on the powerful winds of the whirlwind. The whirlwind, with the hawk above it, rushed up the long gradual slope that led away at a northward angle from Medicine Tail Creek. Higher and higher the hawk circled until it blended into the sky. Meanwhile, the whirlwind gained the top of the slope and kept going. Cloud glanced at Goings, who was shaking his head as he watched the whirlwind disappear over the horizon. Something will happen here, Goings said in a near whisper. I can feel it. Something will happen here. And that concludes Chapter 22.
This program is made possible by funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.